What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game.
Because you know, like at camps and stuff like this, you take the ball out, you ain't getting the ball back. Like, you the last one up the court, they already did their thing. So I stopped there, and I just got into a rhythm and started hooping.
The Lakers should sign Trae Young this summer.
They got to kind of start preparing for, like, if LeBron's last year is this year or next year, whenever it is. And I feel like a pick and roll with AD and a guy like Trae Young would be deadly.
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Welcome to All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio, in partnership with Showtime.
Welcome back, man. Season 2 of All the Smoke.
We got a real special guest.
What's up with you, Brody? With the virtual handshake.
I'm gonna tell y'all something that I never told nobody.
I want All the Smoke.
Welcome back, All the Smoke, Season 2, with a very special guest today. Steven Jackson had to attend to a family emergency, so he won't be with us today. But I have my former coach, mentor, someone I look up to in this space, Steve Kerr. Welcome to the show.
Matt, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. You just told me, I didn't know, but you guys are out there in the Bay Area in your bubble right now practicing. How's that going?
It's going well. You know, we were obviously one of the 8 teams that didn't qualify for Orlando. And so some of that was a positive. I mean, let's be honest, the type of season we had, we didn't really want to go down to Orlando, sit in a hotel room for a month and play meaningless games. On the other hand, as we watched all those teams playing and we were not able to get together ourselves in practice, we realized how quickly we were falling behind. So, you know, all 8 teams now have been given this space by the league. And so everybody's doing an in-market bubble. So we're in San Francisco. We're just going back and forth from the hotel to our facility. And we're getting good work in. And it's been really productive. So, you know, trying to make the best of the situation.
How long do you guys actually are in this bubble?
It's 2 weeks. And totally voluntary. You know, this was not something that was required. So we have most of our guys here. Steph and Draymond are not. They both had family stuff that they needed to tend to. But we've got the rest of the group. Clay is here, Andrew Wiggins, all of our young players from last year. And then we've got some players from our G League team as well. And the biggest thing, honestly, Matt, is just the guys getting to play 5-on-5 for the first time. Mm-hmm. In like 6 months. I mean, it's been a long time. So just to feel the contact and the joy of playing basketball again has been really good for yes. Everybody.
How's Clay looked? I mean, obviously the world's been waiting on his comeback. I love that he got to actually take the adequate amount of time, because I feel like too often as players we're rushed back, or, you know, the game is calling us or the team needs us back. Clay got to take the right amount of time to recover, and we'll see a healthy Clay Thompson next year. How's he been with this kind of being his first run, first contact in a long time?
Yeah, Clay's looked great, and I've seen him a couple of times during the quarantine in Orange County, and so I've watched him work out over the last few months a couple of times and kept up to speed with him. So I was already aware that he was doing well and feeling really good. But this is just the kind of the next natural step, you know, to be on the floor with 9 other guys.
Right.
And so it's been really good for him. He looks great. His rhythm and his timing aren't there, but there's no way that it would be, given that he's been off for a year and a half. But he's healthy. He's feeling good. And it's been great to have him in the building. And obviously, just thinking about next season with him, with Steph, with Draymond, with Andrew Wiggins, you know, we can start to think about having a good team again.
Yeah, that's going to be good. We'll get back to basketball in a little bit. We're going to, you know, start with some other stuff. Obviously, we're in a crazy time right now in our country. You've been someone I've admired from a standpoint of you haven't let your position of who you are hold back your true feelings. You've always been very outspoken and passionate when you speak. Obviously, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of, I don't even know what we want to call it, a change, hopefully for the better for our country. Like I said, you've always been someone outspoken. Obviously, I think your past, and we'll get into your past, but I think your past has helped you be very confident in who you are and what you speak about. Where did that come from as far as, hey, you know, I'm going to speak my mind regardless if I'm the head coach of the Golden State Warriors or I'm just a man on the street?
Well, it's a good question. I think I've always felt a responsibility, just a conviction inside to try to do the right thing and say the right thing. But I never really said much politically when I was playing. But then again, nobody really asked either. You know, it was a different time,
different time, right.
Totally different era. I do remember speaking out against the Iraq War when I played for the Spurs living in San Antonio. And that was not a popular position to take. And it was kind of my first sort of foray into public protest. And, you know, San Antonio has 5 military bases. You know, military influence in that town is really, really important. And so to, you know, make my feelings known about the war was not an easy thing because I wanted people to know that my words had nothing to do with the military. They just had everything to do with humanity and you know, where things were heading. And so that was kind of my first time where I felt uncomfortable, but knowing that I was speaking out in the right way. And right. So that gave me a little feel for what was to come. And I think now we're obviously in a totally different era where the times are really calling for people to speak out, and we all have this enormous platform given the state of media, social media. As coaches, you know, on a typical road game, I do 3 media sessions a day. That's insane, you know. So I'm getting questions every day on politics and, you know, social issues. So it's now it seems almost part of the job, really.
Synonymous, right? They go hand in hand now. And for so long, it was stick to sports, and politics and sports don't mix. But I completely agree with you. I think they go hand in hand now. And I one also who speak out, but I think, like you said, it's people with platforms and who have a voice that travel. And obviously, you know, through our careers, we've been able to, you know, build this platform that has allowed us to, when we speak, people listen. So we're obviously in tune with other things outside of our profession, such as politics, such as family, such as there's so many more facets to who we are as human beings. We're not just athletes. So I applaud you at the position you take and the stance you take and really the vulnerability you put yourself in speaking out on issues, like you said, that aren't always politically correct, I guess, but they're socially and morally correct.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I mean, you've got to feel it in your heart, and you got to have a conviction, and then ultimately the most important thing is to have real knowledge to go with it. You know, the education of what you're speaking of, and I think that's what I've really tried to do over the last, say, 4 months with this social movement, this movement for racial justice really heating up. And given the time off that we've had, I've just been trying to educate myself and read as much as I can about racism. I've read some incredible books that have taught me so much and helped me realize that the reality is, even though I've always kind of felt like I was educated and open-minded, I was pretty ignorant to a lot of what Black Americans face. You know, I really was. I've been playing with Black teammates and friends since I was, you know, in junior high, growing up in Los Angeles in integrated schools. And yet I felt over the last few months, you know, kind of humiliated. Like, oh my God, how do I not know about Black Wall Street? You know, how do I not know about some of these awful, awful times in our history where the Black community has just been devastated by violence, by all kinds of horrific acts that nobody taught us in school, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's been most eye-opening for me, is just the realization that we are all, when I say we, I mean white people, we're all blind to a lot of this stuff. And it's on us to learn and to understand and to put ourselves in someone else's shoes and, yes. and understand what's happening and why and what can we do to change it.
I think you hit it on the head, too, because it's not taught. So, I mean, you have to really go out there and search and look and try to educate yourself. And the ability to open your mind up enough to not only be present within yourself and what you have going on, but the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes. Because as a white man, you can learn as much as you want, but you'll never understand the feeling that a Black person will go to. But all we want you guys to do is try to understand. You know what I mean? And yeah. I think there's been a turn, there's been a shift in the paradigm where people are actually willing to do that now because of the George Floyd situation. Unfortunately, normally when African Americans are gunned down by law enforcement, it's a shot and they're dead. And I think for 8.5, almost 9 minutes, almost the time of an NBA quarter, we watched a man suffer and call for his mother and plead for his life. And I think that really pulled on the heartstrings of America, and it really started opening up people's eyes and making people realize that, you know, hey, there's a real issue in this country, and now is the time to address it. I feel we're still going through it, but I definitely feel like we're going to turn the corner, and good things are coming, but it takes things like what you're doing to educate yourself, and then not only educate yourself, but then spread what you're learning. You know what I mean? Like I said, you do a great job of utilizing your platform to speak what you've learned. Fast forward to the NBA bubble. How do you feel like the NBA did be able to create an environment, a safe environment, not only for the players, but then also for the players to continue to carry their messages through social justice and the initiatives that the NBA has put upon their shoulders to try to help, you know, be a small part of change?
Yeah, I thought the league did a really good job of, first of all, creating a safe environment. And the bubble by really every measure has been a resounding success. And the first thing I do is give credit to the players and coaches and administrators who are down there and who have been there for over 3 months now. If you look at the Lakers and the Heat, I mean, the sacrifice that all those players, those organizations are making for the rest of us to keep the league going, I want to make sure I reference that, because it's been hugely important for the league to be able to put games on TV and to entertain our fans and keep things going. From a racial justice standpoint, the great thing with the NBA is that I think the players have always felt the support, maybe not always, but in the last period of time, decade, couple of decades, the players and coaches have felt the support of the league management. In large part, you know, we've been really led in a powerful way by Adam Silver. His very first act as commissioner was kicking.
We were all part of that.
Out. Yeah,
right. We were in the playoffs when that happened, which is insane. But that, it was a huge first step. A lot, you know, for that to be your first issue, and he handled it swiftly and gracefully.
It was beautiful, and it felt empowering. And I can only speak as a white man, but I was proud that to be part of a league that said, okay, like, we're going to really address this stuff and we're going to support our players and our coaches. So I think going into the bubble, you know, there's that foundation that's already there, where there's a trust level between the players and management. Not that everything's perfect, but I think there's a trust level. Now, fast forward to the Jacob Blake shooting, and the players kind of throw their hands up and say, we can't do this anymore. My take on that, as I sat at home, obviously I was not in the bubble, I just sensed an incredible frustration of a group of players who had dedicated this entire season to the Black Lives Matter movement, to social and racial equity and justice. using their platforms to spread the message throughout this time. And then same old thing, just black man getting shot by cops seven times in front of his family. And combined with the fact that these guys had already been in Orlando for a couple of months away from their families, it's like, to me, it just looked like everybody threw their hands up and said, we can't do this. Like, we can't just right. perform for your entertainment and not see real change. Right. And so last thing, and I'm rambling a little bit, but I think this is important. I think the reason that was an important time, Matt, was that the players missed a couple of games. They sat out and they said, we're not playing. And they used that as leverage to get some concessions from the owners in terms yep. of opening up arenas for voting centers. And I think there were some financial considerations in terms of donating money to social causes. To me, the reason this is so important is that the what can really change things is corporate America deciding to jump on board this train Absolutely. And putting their money where their mouth is and changing policy, changing the way we police, the way we go about our business, the way we protect each other. It has to come from rich white people, to be perfectly blunt.
Absolutely. Rock the vote. In your opinion, how important is it for you and to everyone else to not only vote on the federal level, but the local and state level as well?
Yeah, it's huge. And you know, I've read all the stats. I mean, young people generally don't vote. You know, it's the numbers are staggering. And I think it's like one in five, if, you know, between the ages of 18 and 30 in the last election, if that actually voted. And yet the future of our country is at stake. And so because of this movement, because there's so many young people really of every race and background who are so invested in this movement, they got to back it up. You know, they have to back it up and show up at the polls and help create the change that they're calling for. And it can only happen if they get out and vote.
All right. Absolutely. You had a very unique upbringing with your father moving around, you know, had spent some time in Beirut, Egypt, France, Tanzania. What was it like as a young child growing up in so many different cultures?
It was a real blessing, although I didn't realize it at the time, Matt. You know, my dad was a professor at UCLA, and I just wanted to live in L.A. and go to UCLA basketball games and, you know, play sports with my friends. And then my dad would come home and he'd say, all right, we're going to, you know, pack up the VW van and put it on a boat to Egypt. And, you know, we're going to go live in Egypt for the next 2 years. And when you're 10 years old,
right?
Like, what? We're doing what? So not exactly something that thrilled me at the time, but I look back on it. It was the best education I ever could have had to live in Cairo for 3 years, also in France. It was actually Tunisia, not Tanzania, but
All
right. The point is the same. It's living in a different culture, totally different part of the world. It just gives you an entirely different perspective on life, and it gives you an empathy for other people and an awareness that, you know, we all come from different places, but we're basically all looking for the same thing. We get, you know, all these political and racial differences get in our way, and suddenly you've got horrible inequities and atrocities happening, and it's insane because we're all just flesh and blood. And Absolutely. I think getting that perspective as a kid was really important for me.
Through that process, where did basketball fit in? Is that where you found, when did you find your passion for the game, and who were some of the people you looked up to in the game?
Well, I was a Bruin at heart. I know you like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but my first game was at Pauley Pavilion. I was 5 years old, and Bill Walton was playing for UCLA. And so I was raised during that heyday when UCLA was winning year after year, and John Wooden was the coach, and And so to that's where I fell in love with the game. Walking into Pauley Pavilion for the first time and hearing the band play and watching the team, and every seat was filled, and the crowd noise and the energy, it was just invigorating. And that's where I fell in love with it. And then I played all sports, like we did back then. I know you played baseball and football, and I did the same. And so I just played sports all the time, but basketball was my favorite. And when I was overseas, I was able to play. That was one of the good things about basketball, was that, people played basketball in Egypt. They didn't play baseball or football. So that helped. I just had an outdoor hoop at our school and played on the school team, and it was fun.
Yeah. Finishing up your high school career in California, not very highly recruited, you end up at Arizona as part of Lute Olson's first recruiting class. What was that like playing for such a legendary coach? Obviously, we lost him not too long ago. Rest in peace to Coach. What was that experience like being a part of his class, going to, wanting to go to UCLA, ending up at Arizona, and then having a successful career at Arizona?
Yeah, it was sort of unexpected. I finished my senior season without a scholarship offer, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. So everything kind of happened at last second, and it turned into the break of my lifetime, because to go to Arizona and learn from Coach Olson, and then to, he built the program so quickly. So within a few years, I was playing with NBA players like Sean Elliott and Judd Bushler and Sean Rooks. And I mean, we were loaded. Tom Tolbert, Kenny Lofton was on our team, who went on and had an amazing big league career. And so Lute built this incredible program quickly. And so to be part of it and to learn from him and to have the foundation upon which the rest of my life has been built was just the ultimate gift. So I will forever be thankful for Coach Olson and what he meant to my life.
Do you apply anything, most likely, that you learned from him to your coaching style you have now?
I do. I think I've probably taken a little something from all the coaches that I've played for. But from him, it was, there was such an environment of, this is something special. Like, you're part of something special. And you felt that the first day you walked in, and he made it feel that way through the work, through the mission that we were on, through the family vibe that was there. And so I think I've taken that. I always want players who come to the Warriors to feel like they're part of something special. And that's how coach approached it.
Absolutely. Your father accepts a role as president of American University in 82. Unfortunately, January of 1984, still while you're at Arizona, your father is killed. How did that tragedy impact you, being thousands of miles away, and then also obviously impact your family?
Yeah, so he was one of the early victims of terrorism during, this age of terrorism that we're in. It really began kind of in the late 70s with the hostage situation in Iran at the American embassy. And then, the early 80s, there were various, hijackings and kidnappings and bombings and in the Middle East. And so my dad was killed by two gunmen outside of his office. I was 18 at the time. Freshman year at Arizona, and just crushed me, just destroyed me. And I was really close with my dad. I have three siblings. We were all really, really close. And it's hard to know how to function when something like that happens, because I suppose a lot of us just live in a little cocoon growing up. Assuming things go well for us as a child, like they did for me, I was pretty innocent and, didn't think anything like that would happen to me. So when it did, it was devastating. But, I'm proud of my family. Everybody, really stuck together. My siblings, my mom, everybody has, moved on and with their lives and done really well. And we think about our dad every day. But you keep Keep moving forward.
I lost my mom 2007 to cancer. What role did basketball play for you in helping you not necessarily get over it, but try to, you know, start life after your father?
Yeah. I think it was my sanctuary for sure. You know, just going to the gym. And, you know, I remember about a few days after my dad died, we had a game. And actually the next day I went to practice, you know, and Coach Olson said, "Are you sure you want to practice?" And I said, "What else would I want to be doing?" You know, and it wasn't like some heroic act. It was just, what else do you do?
Right.
You know, you're just at home and you're sitting there, you're thinking about everything. It's a miserable time. And so to get on the court for a couple of hours and lose yourself in the game and be with your friends and, you know, feel the endorphin kick of, you know, intense energy and exercise, it all helps. It's very therapeutic. And it, you know, people might think it sounds insensitive, but it's really not. It's just part of that process of immediate grief, you know, that the game was like the one thing during the day that I could look forward to.
Yeah, that was the same. I played 2 days after my mom passed, and to, like you said, lose yourself for that 2.5 hours to just something you love. Although every time there was a foul call or a whistle was blown, you know, you obviously revert back to missing your father, to missing my mom. But basketball was a huge part, and obviously my support system, which was my team with the Golden State Warriors at the time, with that We Believe team, was tremendous in kind of, you know, being a shoulder to lean on and allowing me to be okay to grieve and be those people you needed them to be. It was a special experience. But like I said, I really think basketball helped me transition through that point in my life.
Well, your teammates become a family for sure, especially, you know, a team like that. I mean, you know, I remember I was in broadcasting at the time, and I did some of your games, and I remember you going through that loss, and I remember, you know, just and of course we knew each other already because you had been in Phoenix before that when I was in management with the Suns, and so I was. You know, just feeling for you and watching you and just knowing exactly what you were going through because I went through the same thing. But that game and your teammates, that's what you have to rely on.
Absolutely. How special was that 88 Final Four team you guys had? You name it, same the guys, Sean Elliott, Kenny Lofton, Tom Tolbert, Anthony Cook, a young Jed Bushler. What was that experience like? I think Kansas with Danny Manning won the championship that year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we lost to Oklahoma in the Final Four. It's the one game, Matt, honestly, that I still think about to this day. I don't think about any of the good ones. I really don't. I only think about that one because I played so poorly and I shot 2 for 13. Not Oof. That I, you know, have kept track. And it was so painful because we had an incredible team. So did Oklahoma, and they were fantastic and they beat us. And then Kansas, as you said, they upset them in the finals. But I think about that game still. The season was so special. Those guys remain my best friends to this day. The guys from that team, and you know, we still have that bond that's going to exist forever. So I've been lucky just to not only be on great teams, but be on teams that just were really close, you know, and where I made really good friends, and so much fun to stay in touch with old teammates.
Absolutely.
You know, just touch Over base the years. With them. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a two-part question. When did the NBA become reality? And then once you made it, when did you feel like you found your footing in the NBA and you felt like you belonged?
Man, that's a great question. It really didn't become a reality to me. I guess I realized my senior year in college that maybe I had a chance. And I got drafted. I was the last pick in the second round by the Suns. And when I made the team, it didn't feel like I was really there yet. I just was on the end of the roster. So the next few years, I got traded to Cleveland, played for Lenny Wilkins, who was a fantastic coach. We had really good teams with Mark Price and Brad Doherty, Larry Nance, Craig Elo, Ron Harper. And I found my footing for a couple seasons during that time. You know, had a couple good years, but I was really still a fringe guy for most of my career. And to be honest, I'm not sure I ever felt 100% comfortable that I belonged. You know, and maybe that's what drove me. I always just kind of felt like, you know, I could get cut at any time. And so as a result, I put in the work and I competed and I just kept sticking around. And I ended up playing 15 years, which is sort of shocking. I still can't believe that my career lasted that long. But I was fortunate and kind of ended up in the right place at the right time in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. With Chicago, you end up in Chicago in 93. You guys go on a three-peat run from 96 to 98. Obviously, with The Last Dance being such a huge success and winning a lot of awards, what do you remember from that time? Obviously, I'm sure that refreshed you a lot. Were there things that you saw that, like, that shit didn't happen that way, or things you completely forgot? What was that experience like, kind of going? Because you guys missed the social media generation, you know? So that was almost like us being able to see a social media version of you and Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Phil and Dennis and all the stuff you guys went through. What was it like just sitting back, like, watching stuff that happened over 20 years ago?
Well, it was really fun because, you know, at the time, they didn't have all the sort of Hard Knocks style shows, you know, with teams. Like, nobody was allowed behind the scenes.
Yeah, no behind the scenes at all.
Nothing. Like, even NBA entertainment, you know, they might be allowed in the locker room during the championship celebration, but you'd never see a camera in a team meeting. You know, you'd never, you know how now, like, you know, let's listen in on Frank Vogel during his halftime speech during the playoffs.
Never.
Like, that's never. So when Phil told us that the cameras were going to be behind the scenes and, you know, why he was allowing it was kind of shocking. And then seeing all those guys every day was really weird. The first month you just felt so exposed. And I'm still not sure it was a great idea. I don't think I would allow it as a coach. I think it's, you're opening yourself up to a lot of potential problems. But I'm really glad that it happened, because now, you know, to watch it 22 years later, especially with my kids who were babies at the time, you know, and now they're all grown up. So to watch with them and for them to see kind of what life was like for me back then was really fun.
What was it like? I mean, I'm sure this is a common question, playing with Mike. You know, we heard you guys had your differences at times, but just overall, him as a teammate, him as a competitor, and is there a friendship there?
There's a mutual respect that that exists, and we don't really stay in touch, but we see each other maybe once or twice a year, whether it's at a game in Charlotte or All-Star Weekend, or, you know, maybe a golf tournament or something in Lake Tahoe. Like, we just seem to run into each other once in a while because we're kind of, you know, traveling the same circuit. And it's always a great reunion. You know, it's so much fun to kind of relive those days and to ask about, you know, our teammates and talk about, you know, the good times back then. And being his teammate was hard. You know, he was really tough on everybody because his whole philosophy was he had to toughen us up to get us ready for the playoffs and the finals. And so he came after us, and you had to stand up to him. You had to sort of survive the MJ test, you know, and the guys who survived it, he had immense respect for him. And so, you know, people know about the fight I got into him, that we got into together. And that was just about him kind of testing me. And and I probably the best thing I ever did was not take his crap and, you know, stood back up, and he respected it, and we got along ever since. So all good.
That was a similar, you know, obviously we weren't teammates at the time, but like I said, I think getting a chance to play against Kobe for so long, and he'll test you mentally, physically, obviously as an opponent. But then, you know, it came to a head in the 2009, 2010 situation with the ball fake. And, you know, we almost ended up fighting at that point. But what a lot of people didn't know was at the end of that season, he personally called me. I didn't even have his number. For some reason, I just picked up and it was him. He's just like, you know, anyone crazy enough to fuck with me is crazy enough to play with me. Do you want to be a Laker? And, you know, similar, you know what I mean? Like, the great ones will test, and they want guys that aren't going to back down from anything. And obviously, you earned Mike's respect through that, and then you guys went on to win some championships. Him coming back in 95, you guys losing to Orlando, and then coming out and having that tremendous 96 season where you guys go 72-10. What was that like? I mean, to lose 10 games, and then obviously as a coach, you surpassed that record, which no one thought would ever be broken. But as a player in that moment, what was that time like?
It was incredible, Matt, because none of us had ever experienced anything like it. But, you know, the fact that Michael had left the game for a couple of years just completely recharged him. Between him having a full offseason to prepare and being recharged and motivated, and then Dennis coming aboard from the Spurs during an off-season trade, we were just revitalized, the whole franchise. And I remember the media asking us about possibly winning 70 before the season started. And we were all, you got to be kidding me. Nobody's going to win 70. And yet we just blitz teams right out of the gate. And I think we were 41-3 at one point. It was like, jeez, we were just looking at each other like, this is insane. This doesn't happen. But it was that perfect storm because of his absence and because of Dennis's arrival and just this amazing energy that existed and Phil's genius as our coach, just the way it all happened. And by the way, Scottie Pippen was one of the great basketball players in the league at the time.
Absolutely.
It was an amazing, amazing run.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
What was it like with Dennis? You saw stuff and it fucking blew me away when he left for Vegas and Phil being Phil. I got a chance to play for Phil his last year before he announced to us he had cancer and he was going to step away from the game. And when I tell people, like, that's what I saw in you when I came to Golden State, was Phil implemented his system as you did, and then you kind of take a step back, and you're not the rah-rah unless you have to cuss someone out. You trust the players you put out there to allow us to create and play the game and see the game through our eyes. What was it like? Kind of a two-part. First of all, what was Dennis like, and then playing for someone like Phil Jackson?
Well, it's a good question, because the way Phil coached Dennis really was the key to everything. And it really informed me about what coaching was about, you know, because Phil demanded certain things of Dennis and then got out of his way. And I saw how powerful that was. You know, the idea of giving someone a vision and then letting them go and then occasionally reining them back in, show them the vision again, letting them go again. That's powerful. You know, to me, that's coaching because these players are artists, man. They're so gifted at this level, especially. And, you know, if you're going to call every play and try to orchestrate everything, you're overthinking things and you're not letting the players be who they really are. The way Phil handled Dennis was genius. The first year was incredible because, you know, Dennis was so excited to be part of the team, and he was so different, but he connected with guys in strange ways. Like, he wouldn't say anything for a week, you know. But you like, there was this energy from him that he, you know what, that's a good dude. Like, you could tell he had a good soul, and he was vulnerable in that way. Like, he allowed you to see his soul and what he was about, but he didn't communicate a whole lot. So you had to understand him and get to know him a little bit.
Beautiful mind. 97 finals, MJ flu game, his amazing game. And then you hit the game winner in game 6. How did your life change after that?
I think in some ways it was validation that I belonged. You know, you asked that question earlier, when did I feel like I belonged? Maybe that's the answer. Maybe it took that long. I think that was maybe my 10th year in the league. But, you know, I hadn't hit many big shots before that. And so hitting that shot felt like I actually belong here. I had to prove it to myself, but I had to prove it to other people also. And then it also led to another contract. You know, I was a free agent couple of years later, and the Spurs gave me a 5-year contract, which was the most money I ever made in my career, which allowed me to buy a house in San Diego and you know, take care of my family. And so it changed a lot of things. I think hitting that shot probably got me my job in TV, you know, because playing for the Bulls and having a big moment took me from a place of relative obscurity to, oh, we know that guy. And, you know, so that season, those years in Chicago and hitting that shot, it all added up to kind of giving me a boost to another level in my own career and life.
I love it. Now, obviously, with the Last Dance, you know, you guys won your third title in 98. Seeing Last Dance, there was so much behind the scenes that obviously we didn't know. I don't know. I'm not sure if you guys were, but did you guys really feel like this was really going to be the last run? Or at any point, did you just think it was talk? Or when you guys knew that 98 season hit, you guys really knew it was going to be the last run?
We knew it was done. We knew we were done. And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, the Last Dance came on whenever it was. I guess it was June, July. So it came on and it finishes up. And after the 10th episode, I had, you know, all my friends are calling me and the media is asking me, you know, why didn't the Bulls keep the team together? You know, what was Reinsdorf thinking? Why didn't they just sign everybody and keep going? And I think that's the logical sort of thought.
But it's never that simple.
It's never that simple. And what I've really realized, you know, coaching the Warriors and feeling that pressure that you feel, you know, going to the finals, you know, multiple years, in our case, 5 years in a row with the Warriors, with the Bulls, it was, you know, 6 times in 8 years. I think there's an emotional toll that is so big that it's hard for people to understand that when a team loses its edge, it's, you know, its energy, its motivation, it's just over. And so people can say, you know, if you guys had come back, or, you know, if Michael hadn't left for baseball, you would have won 8 championships in a row. I call bullshit. Like, it just, you know, there's just no way. There's no way. There was too much fatigue, and it ended for a reason. It was supposed to end. It was just, that was the time.
Speaking out on that as a player and what you saw and what you felt, did you feel that with this current team? Did you feel like you guys had done, obviously injuries played a huge part kind of in you guys is not winning again, but did you feel like, because we're in a different era now, so everything is publicized, small arguments don't stay in the locker room, criticisms right. don't stay in the locker room, everything is for public consumption now. So did you feel as a coach, what you felt as a player in Chicago at all in that Golden State organization or locker room, so to speak?
I did. I could feel it a little bit, you know, the last year when we lost to Toronto in the finals. It was a different type season. You know, we could just feel the connection wasn't as powerful. And it was just human nature. You know, there's nothing like the climb. The climb is the best,
yes.
the best part,
yes.
you know. You get to the top and you got to start over again. That's you know, it's pretty hard, but it's worth the climb. But you try, you got to make that climb three, four, mm. five times. Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. So we felt that exhaustion. I thought last year, Draymond, Steph, and Clay desperately needed to get away. And unfortunately, it took really horrible circumstances. For Draymond or for Steph and Clay with season-ending injuries, even Kevin Durant, you know, after three straight years of going to the finals, you know, I think he probably needed a rest. And I hated that it happened the way it did with his injury, but you know, making these runs to me, that's why what LeBron has done.
Incredible.
It makes no sense. It makes
people
no
don't
sense.
Understand, and I think obviously because you played and you were a coach, people don't understand the mental drain it takes on your body, on your yeah. family, on everyone around you as well. Because like I said, it from the outside looking in, oh, you keep KD and you guys keep running, or Mike doesn't go play baseball and you guys, it's never that simple. Mm. It's such an emotional roller coaster. I mean, and not to mention the physical grind, but the mental grind mm-hmm. is just as tough, if not tougher, than that actual physical grind.
Yeah, and while you're going through that grind, there's four or five other teams that are on the climb.
Yep.
That are incredibly motivated, that have been building their teams specifically to beat you,
yep.
and that can't wait to play you. And you're already exhausted, and now you see these people climbing below you, trying to pull your leg down. You're like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know, so it's yeah. It's exhausting. So you know, yeah. 10 finals appearances for LeBron, but I think if I'm not mistaken. This is 9 out of the last 10 years, right? That he will be
in the finals.
That's insane. That's mm-hmm. insane. Yeah.
And you guys had a lot to do with his record in the finals too. But you well, back he, to your yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, he got us. He got our best
he
team.
Did.
You know, the 73 win team was you know, not our most talented team, but you know, that team was steamrolled through everybody, and then they got us. So that one stung.
We're going to get to the Warriors in specific, but I want to continue with what you had going on. So you leave a 98, MJ retires, Scotty goes to Houston. If I'm not mistaken, you go to San Antonio, you guys win that next shortened year, correct? With a
yeah.
veteran David Robinson and a very young Tim Duncan. You landed on your feet. You leave a three-peat and you go to pop in the Spurs and you
yeah.
keep the train going. What was that like?
Yeah, it was really weird because it was a lockout season, as you mentioned, 50-game season. You know, Pop wasn't Pop yet. He was maybe in his third year coaching. I didn't really know anything about him. But to go there and to immediately be part of a championship team was kind of crazy, you know. I felt like I just sort of fell off of a train and landed on a bandwagon, and you know, they handed me a trophy and I was like, okay, here we go again. Like it was really bizarre. But I think the experience that I had in San Antonio, even though I didn't play a ton, I made a much bigger impact in Chicago than I did in San Antonio on the court. But what I learned in San Antonio has been so important for me in my coaching career, and playing with such incredible guys. Tim Duncan is as good a teammate as there is. on earth. And to go through that experience was remarkable, given that I had just been granted the opportunity to play with Michael Jordan and the Bulls. So right. I've lived right.
Absolutely. So after that, you head to Portland, and then you come back and get your fifth ring. You know, my colleague was a part of that team as well. You guys both hit big shots to help secure your fifth ring, and that was your final season. What made you say, it's time?
Well, I was 37, and my knees were... Probably my last 3 years playing, my knees were really hurting. And I was popping Vioxx, you know, just to feel capable of, you know, moving the way I wanted to move. And it was so frustrating, you know, not that I was ever very quick or fast, but, you know, you want to feel your best to be able to play. And so when you get old, and you probably remember this, you know, at the tail end of your career, you know, one day you feel 25 and the next day you feel 38 and you can't figure out why, or, you know, you get banged up. And when you're young, you know exactly why you're banged up. And you get older and you get out of bed and you go, why does my left hip hurt? You know, and so that 3 years of that, 37, we won the championship in 03. It was just time. It felt right.
Yeah. No, I felt that to the extreme. You know, I was 37 with my final year with you guys, and it pissed me off because a sprained ankle had never taken me out. Like, I'd sprain my ankle and I'd always bounce right back. But this sprained ankle was the sprained ankle of them all, and it just wouldn't heal. And by the time, and I tell people, you know, obviously I took in less money my whole entire career to get into a winning situation because I wanted to win. And I finally get an opportunity to come to you guys when, unfortunately, KD goes down. I step in, you know, you insert me. It was crazy. So I'm at working my kids out. DeMarcus, I'm in Sacramento. The Kings talk through me to get to DeMarcus all the time. So they're reassuring me the whole time. They're not trading DeMarcus. Oh, he's good. He's, you know, we're a game and a half out of the playoffs. He's good. He's not going nowhere. We're going to make this playoff run. We're going to play the Warriors in the first round. So we have this whole game plan for Sacramento in the first year in our new arena. All-star break hits, and DeMarcus gets traded while he's on the podium asking questions. And I'm like, what the fuck? You guys have just been telling me for the last 3 weeks to a month he's not going nowhere. So DeMarcus gets traded. Fast forward, I talked to Vlade. I'm like, Vlade, I'm too old to try to rebuild. You know, I need to try to win. And he understood. He let me go. KD goes down. I get an opportunity to come in. And I went from being at KFC one night to talking to you on the phone because I just got done working the Twins. I was like, you're like, hey, we need you in Chicago. I'm like, holy shit. I catch a flight the next day and then get to Chicago and I play 25 minutes. I'm like, oh shit, I'm back in the NBA. Let's go. Yeah. You know, so for that opportunity to arise, and then KD comes back and I get hurt the game KD. So people don't know, like, I never got a chance to play with KD. Like, we were on the same team, but he was hurt. And then the first game back, I got hurt. And then I played sparingly in the playoffs. But back to your point, I couldn't get over that sprained ankle. And a sprain, I'm a football player. I played through everything. And that fucking sprained ankle wouldn't get better. So it was just, it was humbling. And you know, we got a chance to win a ring as a team. And it was a tremendous opportunity. But I was just like, it's getting time. And you know, and that's why I wanted to ask, like, it was my 14th year. It was your 15th year. Like, when you start listening to your body, could I have played a couple more years? Probably. But I was ready to see what was next in my life. And obviously, you know, you felt a similar way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but how lucky are we to make it that far,
man,
so that where we could actually say, okay, we know, now it's time. Most players, their careers end before that. I have to tell one quick story just for your listeners, because it's one of my favorite NBA stories from coaching. But, you know, one of the things, you know, that I believe as a coach, and I really learned this from Pop, was, you know, involving family members in anything that you can with team stuff is really fun. It's just, you know, so we always invite guys to bring their kids, their families on the plane if they want. And so you probably know where I'm going with this, but we had a game in San Antonio, and we were staying out in the Hill Country, the Hyatt. We have a breakfast meeting, and you bring your boys to the breakfast meeting, the Twins, and everybody's having breakfast. And then, you know, we're going to get the meeting started. And you were like, Coach, should I send the kids back? I was like, no, they're good. They're good. And so they're hoopers, right? They're at the time, they were probably, I'm guessing, 8 years old, 7 years old.
Seven or eight. Yep. Seven or eight.
So they would, you know, they'd shoot around before practice and stuff, and they're hoopers. They love this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was Mike Brown's scout. So I said, Mike, why don't you go through the matchups? And he goes, all right, we're going to change the starting lineup. You hadn't started the previous game. And I'm sitting in the back just observing. So you're kind of sitting right in front of me with your boys. Mike Brown's beyond that. So Mike gets up. He goes, all right, we're gonna start tonight. We're going to start Steph, Clay, Matt, you're going to start at the three and you're going to guard Kawhi. And your boys, the twins, get up and they start going. They start pumping their fists. They're like, yeah, yeah. It was one of my all-time favorite moments, because that's really, you know, ultimately that's what it's about. You know, right. You want to be able to enjoy everything with your family. And how cool was that? Like, you know, there were your boys watching this team meeting and, hell yeah, dad's starting tonight.
Yeah. No, that was the best experience, obviously, for me to be able to come to a team like that and just see how you were able to manage so many different stars and egos and personality and come along for the common goal. But outside of that, the kids' ride was the best time. Like the chance that the people don't know, like the kids flew on the plane. They were in the locker room. They were in our pregame breakfast meetings. Like you couldn't tell these guys they weren't on the Warriors. You know what I mean? Let them, I want to say we were in the Western Finals against Houston, if I'm not mistaken, or and they're shooting with Steph and KD at the end of practice, like shooting three, and like they're just blown away. And so when we finally won the championship, like you, the twins were up. I was sitting in the back just kind of taking it all in. The twins are in the front row.
Yeah, they're in the front.
Trying to hold the – KD got the MVP trophy. They wanted to hold that. Steph got the championship trophy. They were trying – like you couldn't tell the twins that they weren't a part of that team. So that's why I wanted to make sure that, you know, when I came back and got my ring, I got them rings. And kids were on cloud nine. So I thanked you, but I never got a chance to really thank you, because like you said, that was a perfect exclamation on like my kids got to see me play. My kids got to be a part of this special team. It was their favorite team. And then for them to kind of get rings when dad got rings, it was just a perfect time to say goodbye. And I really owe a lot of that to you and obviously the Warriors organization for accepting me back. So thank you very much for that, Coach. I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, and I'll just say it was a pleasure to coach you. Just your competitiveness and your toughness was important in our locker room, the joy that the twins brought every day was great stuff. And Zaza's kids would come in, and you know, sometimes the kids would be having like a 3-on-3 game between David West's son, and so we had a good group. But I really learned that from Pop. You know, Pop was the first coach I ever had who invited family on the plane, and so I remember taking my 5-year-old son, my oldest, on a road trip, and then a few weeks later, my 3-year-old daughter on a road trip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was so excited because she's like, you know, we get to sleep in the hotel. It's like, yep. And she's like, we're going to get room service. We're going to watch a movie. She's like, this is going to be the best night of my life. You know, and it's like, I'll never forget that. And so for Pop to understand that as a coach, like how much that meant to me, it was so powerful that it became a no-brainer for me when I became coach, that got to give the players that joy of seeing their kids in the same environment. It's an amazing feeling.
That's one thing that people don't understand is championship teams are built at the top, and it's the little things like that. Obviously, you need everything to be aligned, and you need plenty of luck, but it starts at top with management. And when I tell people when I play for the Warriors, you guys take care of all the players on your team have to do is obviously fall in line and you know, stay ready. But all you have to do is worry about basketball. You guys take care of family. You guys take care of friends. You guys make it such a warm family environment that, like, you want to go run through a wall for an organization like that. Because I played for the Clippers my first year, and we were practicing at a junior college where we had to keep the back door open to make sure people didn't break into our cars. You know what I mean? It's just like little shit. There's levels to this. And I think you guys did such an amazing job of just – all you guys have to do is go out and focus on basketball. We got everything else. And then, you know, you guys got rings for that. But back to you retiring from the game. You step into the broadcast booth, and then you step into the front office of Phoenix during their runs. What was that transition like from obviously playing? I don't know if you knew you wanted to be a coach. You went to the front office first. But what was that change from being a player to moving into the front office and kind of managing things behind the scenes?
Well, I had a bridge, you know, doing TV for about 4 years before I got into management. And it was important for me to kind of step away from the grind. And so the TV gig with TNT was an incredible time in my life, you know, to be with my family at home. And then I'd fly off and do one game a week. So it was kind of perfect. You know, I got just enough time away to keep my wife happy. So I was out of the house for a couple of days, but plenty of time at home to do the things I wanted to do. And then after about 4 years, I just started feeling that itch to compete and to be involved. And I had this opportunity in Phoenix and I took it, but I was GM for 3 years, but I knew deep in my heart that I wanted to coach, and I didn't love being a GM. You know, I like being on the court. I like being with the players, and I like the highs and lows of winning and losing. Like if you're right in the thick of it, rather than watching from above and trying to make more big picture decisions, I'd rather be in the fight. Mm-hmm. So it was fun to watch the team. We had a hell of a team. You were part of it, you know, with Nash and Grant Hill. And
an older Shaq.
By that time. And we had a couple good runs, but it was not a job that I excelled at. I was not a great GM, to be honest with you.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You were broadcasting during our We Believe times, right? Weren't you broadcasting when we were playing Dallas?
Yeah, I did the final game.
So how loud was that arena? Because I tried to tell people, because I went back for the championship and we were fortunate enough to be on that team, but I still felt like those We Believe crowds were the loudest crowds I've ever been a part of.
Yeah, I agree. I've told people that many times. That game 6 against Dallas, the closeout game, was the loudest arena I've ever heard in my life. It was insane.
It felt like they were shaking the arena. Like we came out to warm up and the stands were already full. Like normally when you go out to warm up, no one's really out there yet. You know, like when individual players, the second they opened the door, the arena was filled and they were all standing. As soon as we came out there for like the real team warm ups, like there was an electricity in there and we knew we were going to blow them out. Like that home fan base was tremendous. You know, obviously transitioning to becoming the Warriors coach, but I kind of wanted to jump ahead a little bit. Obviously having to leave the history of Oakland and Oracle behind and transitioning to obviously the amazing venue you guys have in San Francisco. What do you miss about those Oracle crowds?
I always loved Oracle, even going way back to when I was a player. There was just this energy in that building that didn't exist in every NBA arena. Certain arenas that just feel special, certain crowds that seem to know the game and love the game. The Garden in New York feels that way to me. You know, despite the struggles of the teams over the last couple decades, it's still special to go into the Garden. There's a sense that there's a real basketball history and that the fans know the game. And that's how I always felt coming into Oracle. Going to Toronto, same way. There's this energy in the crowd in Toronto that's really fun to be a part of. Yeah, it's electric. Yeah. Seattle, the Sonics, when, you know, playing the old Sonics teams at Key was amazing. So Oracle's always been a special place. And then obviously to have the run that we did and get to the finals and you know, win a championship at home in 17 and just feeling that energy and the joy of the fans was really amazing.
That's special. So head coach of Golden State, your first crack, replacing Mark Jackson. What was your philosophy and expectations, obviously coming into with a new young team? You start with two core stars and then you find out, you know, Draymond works himself into being a star. What were some of the ups and downs with that young Warrior team and how did you feel like you earned their trust?
Well, I think our whole focus coming in was let's respect what Mark has already built and what the team has already built. That was what 14-15 was our first year. The Warriors had been in the playoffs the previous couple of years. They had a top four defense in the league the previous year when I became coach. So I'm looking at it, I'm like, this is a gold mine. You know, this team is ready to win. They've already become a damn good team. And so let's honor that. Let's respect that. And that was our whole approach in camp was we're not coming in here to reinvent the wheel. We're coming in to help you with the foundation that you guys have already built and let's grow it. Let's get better from here. That was important because the players liked Mark and had great respect for him and he had done an amazing job. He deserved the credit that he had been given. It was controversial when he was let go. So I thought that was the main thing we tried to do was just, hey, let's keep building this thing. And here's a few areas where watching on tape, We think we can get better. But other than that, like, let's keep rolling.
Mm-hmm. We had Steph on the first season of the show, and he said he personally felt like the first one was the best one for him. What was that first journey like? You know, obviously you being there as a player, you walk into an amazing situation. 15, you guys get there. What was that first one like for you as a coach?
Honestly, in terms of basketball, and I've had a lot of amazing moments in my career and been on championship teams, but clinching game six in Cleveland and as a head coach might have been the best feeling that I've ever had in basketball. Because it's different. It's different. Like, a lot of times as a player, I was on those teams. I was a reserve. I might have had a good game here or there, but I didn't. It wasn't me. I wasn't, you know, the one winning the championship, you know, as a player. Mm-hmm. So when you become a coach, it's even more so pronounced because you never touch the floor, right? You never take a shot. You never get a rebound. But what you do feel is this responsibility to the group that you're trying to help them win a championship.
Right.
And so as a coach, it's a different vibe. Like, you didn't do anything yourself, but this group that you're in charge of has accomplished their goal. And that's a special feeling, you know, in any kind of leadership role when the group you're in charge of has that success. It was probably the most gratifying moment of my whole career.
See, that's cool. And obviously, I felt it on a much smaller scale, but, you know, coaching the Twins now, and we have one of the top teams in the country, and seeing their excitement when they start to get stuff and understand. And, you know, we run similar offenses to what you guys do, and I tell them every single night, the Warriors are going to get everyone's best shot. You know, that's the same with my team, because I coach them and everyone knows the Twins now. Every single night, you have to understand how to play with a target on your back. There's no let-ups. But when we finally start winning these championships and we see, I think we're number 8 or number 9 in the whole country right now at 12 years old, you know what I mean? But to see their excitement and know that I don't shoot, I don't play defense, I don't do nothing on that court, but I'm helping them achieve their goals. So I can only imagine on the highest level, which is the NBA, the excitement an opportunity like that would bring for you.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing like playing basketball. You know, once you're done, you can't play anymore. To be involved as a coach, to me, is the next best thing. But winning a championship as a coach is a feeling you can't describe, because you just feel responsible for so many people. Right. You know that so much can go wrong. And if it does go wrong, you feel responsible for that too.
Absolutely.
But when everything clicks, and as it did that first year, oh, man, amazing.
It's a special feeling. How do you feel like your experience as a player with your 72-10 team, we touched on this earlier, and then the experience coaching the 73-9 team, prepared you for that? And did you see any similarities, differences, the pressure night in, night out? And like I just said a minute ago, it didn't matter who you guys were playing. Every single night you were going to get their best shot, and that shit alone is draining mentally and physically. So what was it like, obviously, being a part of it, a player, and then coaching a team that surpassed a record that no one ever thought would be touched?
Yeah, and I was maybe leading that charge, thinking that nobody would ever beat 72. You know, right. Having been through it as a player, I was like, no way.
Right.
But our guys came off that championship in 15, and they were so confident. You know, that's one thing. When you win a championship, there's a deeper level of confidence that you now have. That year, I think we hadn't gotten to the stage of fatigue yet. It was more excitement of, oh my God, we're the best team in the NBA. We're the best team in the world. This is fun, you know? And so that was the similarity, just this vibe of, you know, nobody can touch us, you know, let's go dominate. And so I didn't really have to say a whole lot. It was, you know, just let them go. The only thing I tried to do was, you know, down the stretch, you know, talk about, you know, we're not going to do anything stupid. You know, we're not going to go and push you guys 44, 46 minutes in a game, you know, in order to chase a win that we don't actually have to have. And I tried to play it, you know, pretty conservatively. And for the most part, we did. Our minute totals were pretty low that year. But, you know, there was definitely a feeling of you know, nervousness that, you know, somebody would get injured and the whole thing would go off track.
Yes. So falling short in 16 that season, LeBron and the Cavs got you guys to then landing one of the biggest free agent signings in the history of the game, picking up Kevin Durant. And it was just like, let's go. What was it like knowing that, I mean, obviously there was a bunch of talks when it finally happened, knowing that you were going to be able to add one of the greatest players we've seen to an already amazing team?
Yeah, and not just an amazing player, but a player who was going to fit in perfectly with the way we already played. You know this. I mean, Draymond Green has led us in assists for like 5 years in a row. He's our starting power forward. So we just play basketball and everybody makes plays. And watching Kevin over the years in Oklahoma City, the most skilled guy in the league in terms of shooting, passing, versatility, shot blocking, like it was going to be such a seamless fit because of he was not ball dominant. You know, he didn't have to have the ball in his hands all the time. And of course, neither did Steph. They were both perfectly willing to play off the ball. So it was pretty incredible to watch that group together. One of the best teams in the history of the game, one of the most talented. And to watch them on the floor when we were really clicking was just beautiful.
Special, absolutely special. 17, you get a ring, 18. And then how hard was it? You know, you guys are at the top of the hill and you've been there as a player. You know how mentally draining it is, physically draining it is. How hard was it to see you guys go for that three-peat in 19 and then guys start to get injured?
Yeah, I think, you know, you sort of feel it if you're in the league long enough. Every year, injuries play a role. When we won our first title in 15, Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving were both out. So we'd been on the other end of it too. So, you just sort of go into it as a coach or as a player, and you understand that sometimes things don't go well, sometimes they do, and regardless, you just have to respond and play your best. And I was as proud of that 19 team as I was of any of our championship teams, just from the standpoint of they fought
absolutely.
and almost took it to seven, you know. If Clay doesn't tear his ACL,
I think you guys still win if Clay doesn't get hurt. I mean, that's just my personal opinion.
I think we win that game six because Clay was on fire.
Smoking.
He's rolling. We're at home. And if it goes seven, who knows? But Toronto was great and they deserved it. Great respect for their team and their coaching staff. And they were fantastic. But I walked away from that series as proud of our group as any group that I've ever been around. They were amazing. They were awesome.
Yeah. Speaking of that series, how hard was it managing Kevin wanting to come back, but still you guys trying to be cautious as you possibly can, managing, you know, obviously his injury and knowing how many years he still had to play? How hard of a coaching decision, management decision, doctor decision, his decision, did that play with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really tricky situation. And what we tried to do was just make sure we covered all our bases and trust our training staff, trust the surgeon, and then also bring in, you know, Kevin's own medical people and make sure that everybody was good with him playing before we put him out there. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, I wish we hadn't, because now we know what happened. He tore his ACL. I mean, he tore his Achilles. And so, you know, I think we handled it the way we thought was the best way with, you know, Kevin and his representation and their own medical team putting their heads together with our group. We felt like we were, you know, in the clear, but it was a stark reminder that, you know, medicine is not necessarily math. You know, it's not just either yes or no. There's a gray area in everything. And so when Kevin went down, I was just, my first thought was, oh man, he re-injured his calf. And, you know, the thought was, you know, what a bummer. He's put in all this work and there goes the calf. And it didn't hit me until we walked in at halftime and I saw everybody's faces. I saw the doctors. I saw our trainer. And I saw Kevin. I was like, oh shit. Like this was an Achilles. It's devastating. And, you know, it was, Kevin was heroic in terms of, you know, trying to be out there on the floor with his teammates.
He got off to a great start, too. He came out in that game
amazing.
Cooking. Oh,
he was cooking. You know, he was on fire right away, and seemed like everything was good. But it's one of those ones that we'll forever look back on and go, you know what? We wish we could have that one back, but not from a process standpoint. I think the process we handled in the right way, but I think I learned from that in that even if the process is sound, just go overboard. Absolutely. And don't, you know. I would love to have that one back, but again, hindsight's 20/20.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by 3-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game, King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
I'm not guarding like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. He's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't me?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we're with the home stretch right now, almost finished up. Kevin decides that he wants to leave. How did that hit you personally? Obviously, as a coach, you know it's the business, but how did the organization feel when he felt it was time for him to move on?
It didn't surprise us. We all had a sense that Kevin probably looking to move on and take on a new challenge. He'd been here 3 years and won 2 championships and been finals MVP twice. And it was just for him, in his own personal career, it was time for a new challenge. And we all totally respected that. You know, I always feel like players should control their own destiny, and especially through free agency. And you know, once your contract's up, every player has the right to go wherever he wants. And so there were no hard feelings at all. In fact, it was the opposite. It's like, man, thank you for everything you've done. You helped bring us 2 championships and almost another one, and you brought an incredible amount of joy to Oracle every night, and our fans got to watch one of the best basketball teams on earth. My feeling was thank you and good luck, and you know, get healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. So you came into the coaching space a lot luckier than most coaches. So you came in, you won a championship your first year. You have a hell of a 5-year run. Last year, a little bit of reality sets in. You know, you guys go to a new arena. There's a lot of excitement. Clay's already hurt. Steph ends up going down. So it kind of becomes a development year. And I was talking to Draymond a lot that season, like, hey, man, keep your head. I can see you're about to snap. You know, what was it like coming in at the highest level and winning and having that run and then kind of coming back down to earth last season? And you know, your 2 stars are out. Draymond is still in, but just a season of developing these young guys.
It was a slap in the face for sure. The injuries to Steph and Clay were just killers. Obviously, you're talking about, you know, 2 of the best guards in the league and probably the 2 best shooters in the world. So, you know, when Steph went down in the 3rd or 4th game, whatever it was apparent pretty quickly. Like, this is now a development year. We got to play these young guys and try to help them get better. And You know, a little perspective is usually what happens in life. You know, nobody gets to win every year, and so we had been on this incredible run, and now it was our turn to get smacked in the face, and now it's time to get up off the mat and see if we can have another run in us. We'll see.
I think, obviously, you don't like to ever see anyone get hurt, but I think it was needed. You know what I mean? You guys had such a tremendous run. I think Dre, Clay, and Steph needed a break. You know what I mean? Those guys are probably in that five-year span, probably played more minutes possibly than, you know, some of the guys in NBA history as far as a five-year span. So those guys went on a hell of a run, well rested. So I think I speak for all of us when we say we're excited to see what you guys come back with. I'm going to hit you with a couple quick hitters and we'll be done. One player in your era you wish you would have got a chance to play with?
Patrick Ewing. I loved Ewing's game and his
Big Pat.
competitive desire. He was incredible.
Thoughts on the 2020 Basketball Hall of Fame class, arguably one of the greatest classes. You know, rest in peace, Kobe. But you got a chance to play with a young Timmy and know him well, and then Kevin Garnett.
I don't know my history well enough, but there can't be many classes more decorated than this one. Three all-time greats. Maybe the three best players of their shared era, you know, really, when it comes down to it. But that was devastating. You know, learning of Kobe's death was one of those moments that you'll remember your whole life because of the shock of it, and feeling that shock with our whole team. Was devastating, and it still doesn't even seem real. But you know, this fall with Kobe and KG and Tim all going into the Hall of Fame together, it'll feel, you know, from a basketball standpoint, it feels right. But the fact that Kobe is no longer with us, obviously,
right,
just takes it and completely skews everything. It still doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely. Your thoughts on cannabis and CBD use of professional athletes?
Well, it's funny because I spoke out about this a couple of years ago. You know, I had my own health issues with my back surgery that went wrong. And so I was getting prescribed all these opioids constantly for pain. And, you know, I'd read about this stuff. I'm like, I'm not taking this stuff, this Oxycontin or Vicodin or whatever. And it just seemed so insane. And so, you know, I spoke out about the, you know, that athletes should be allowed to use cannabis. And, you know how we like to play music during our warmups in practice. So I can't remember what song. There was some song about smoking dope or something. And so our video guy puts that song on. JaVale McGee is running down laughing, looking at me like he's puffing. Uh-huh. Everybody's cracking up because I've made this statement. Meanwhile, I had literally tried it for my pain, for my back stuff, and had no success with it. So, and unfortunately, it didn't work. But because I spoke out on it, all of a sudden, like, I got this reputation as the pot guy. Like, oh, there's, you know, I'm like, all right, whatever.
Right.
The players got a good kick out of it anyway.
So, well, I remember seeing you. It hurt my heart because I remember when I was hurt in the Portland series, like how uncomfortable you would lay for a second, you would sit for a second, you would have to stand up for a second, then you would lay for a second. I'm just like, I can't imagine what you were going through that time. And I was to the point where I didn't want to cross player coach boundaries, but I was going to say, coach, let me go in my bag real quick. I got something for you. But it was, you know, it was a little, I think I was a little bit before my time, but I mean, I remember the pain you were in, particularly in Portland. I remember because I was in the locker room icing the whole time, and you couldn't literally sit in the same position for more than 2 minutes. Like, you would try to lay for a second, you would try to sit for a second, you'd have to get up and stand, then you'd have to get up and walk around. I was so close that day to being like, coach, I got a joint for you, man. It's going to change everything. But anyway, last question. Historical, anybody, who are five people you would love to sit down and have dinner with, dead or alive?
Oh, man, that's a really difficult question. That's a good question.
It's a good way to end it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a huge sports fan. Growing up, I was into every sport. And I suppose I would want to speak with some of the people who kind of laid the foundation for what sports are today. Jackie Robinson would definitely be one. I would love to hear his story, what it was really like. And being such a big baseball fan, Babe Ruth would be another. Like, you know, he was the king, and he was, you know, the MJ of his era. And so from the baseball world, those two guys for sure. From a historical standpoint, I don't know. This is a tough one because, you know, there's so much that I'm learning and that I want to learn about American history. And so you kind of want to go back in time to our founding fathers and say, how can we have these parallel universes of, you know, pursuit of happiness, life and liberty, and here's this component of slavery, right? How do you reconcile all that?
Mm-hmm.
Who would we ask about that? You know, Thomas Jefferson. You know, I know Jefferson he owned slaves, right?
Right.
And he helped write the Constitution. And I think going back in time during the course of history, there are a lot of questions about this country that I would want to ask. And, you know, probably starting with the people who were putting it all in place, and
mm-hmm.
you know, what was the thought process? And I don't know. That's only three. I've only given you three.
Two more.
I got to give you two more, don't I?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm doing is I'm showing you how limited my outside activities and interests are. I should be naming like some artists or musicians.
Not at all. This is your dinner table.
This is my show.
Whoever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably Lincoln for that reason. You know, President Lincoln for that very reason, because he would be able to bridge the education gap between what happened in, you know, late 1700s with the founding of our country to all the way up to the Civil War. Like, I'd love to hear that conversation and that viewpoint. And then...
Who gets the last seat at your table?
Last seat. I'll give you one that's a little offbeat, but James Baldwin, the author.
Okay.
I just read a fascinating book about him called Begin Again, and by a writer named Eddie Gloud. It's a beautiful book. And Baldwin had the most unique look at the civil rights era because of his proximity to it and his brilliance as a writer and his friendship with so many of the key figures. He was so deep and powerful as a human being, just his humanity, knowing his story and learning his story has been really, really powerful. If you get a chance, there's a What's documentary about him. Well, the book is called Begin Again.
Begin Again.
Where is it? There we go. Here's the book. Brilliant book.
Okay.
Begin Again by Eddie Gloud. He's a professor at Princeton. But there's a documentary about James Baldwin that I highly recommend. It's called I Am Not Your Negro. And it's about his relationship with Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Dr. King during the civil rights era. And all three men were murdered. Mm-hmm. And Baldwin was writing throughout the 60s about the civil rights era. And here he's watching this great hope that he has for his country. And then these hopes are violently turned back. And his own evolution as a writer, as a human being, and what he went through as a Black American, it's powerful stuff. And one of the key figures during the civil rights movement who our young people should read more about and read his stuff.
Yeah. I put it in my notes as you were speaking, so I'm definitely going to check it out. Coach Kerr, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much. It was an honor to have you sit down. good luck this season. We're excited to see what a well-rested Golden State Warriors team looks like in 2021.
Thank you, Matt. That was really fun. You're doing a great job. And I always enjoy hearing from you. And say hi to the boys. You have a new son, right, Ashton?
I got a little one. Yeah, I got Ashton's 22 months. Yeah, little man. So I started all over. So it's been a blast.
Oh, man. Man, I'll bet he's beloved by those twins. They probably take good care of him.
This guy runs the house already at 22 months. I'm in trouble.
Yeah, I'll bet. Thanks for having me. That was great. Really appreciate it.
That's a wrap. All the Smoke. You can catch us on Showtime Basketball YouTube and the iHeart platform.
This is All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio in partnership with Showtime.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.